Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Ari Berman from Mother Jones Magazine will join us to discuss why ex-convicts in Florida won't be able to vote, and we'll discuss a plan by the Trump administration to preserve white electoral power. Progressive congressional candidate Hector Asaguirre will join us to discuss his race in New Jersey's 8th District. Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down all the major news from this week, and Lucy Flores will join us to discuss the recent Women's March in Washington, D.C. Are you listening to one of our radio affiliates right now? Well, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show podcast, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program commercial-free. The access to years and years of our archives. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down the most important news stories of this week. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, the impeachment trial of the president, the third one in the history of the country, started this week in the Senate on Tuesday. We had a all-day marathon, as it were, of amendments of debate and a debate on amendments, and then ultimately voting on amendments to the resolution that Mitch McConnell had entered and they voted upon as to the rules of the impeachment trial. McConnell had floated a version on Monday, and by Tuesday morning he had to change it because apparently there is some inklings of a semblance of a potential of just very slight uncomfortability that's being expressed by some members of the Republican caucus as to the railroading or the sort of show trial, the fall or the sham trial, as it were, in the Senate. Give me your thoughts about, you know, what we saw this week and just, I don't know, what stood out for you?
Well, let me just say first that I think that what you just said about Mitch McConnell and the rules and being changed at the last minute, I have a strong feeling that was all set up in advance to give Susan Collins and maybe some of the other ones a way to sort of pretend like they were having a positive effect on the trials, you know, neutrality or whatever. I mean, what McConnell had proposed was that the two sides could have 24 hours to make their case, but they had to do it in 2 days, meaning two 12-hour days, and that was it. And he had been saying all along that he was going to, you know, follow the Clinton impeachment process, and that was not it. They gave them that amount of time, 24 hours, but they allowed him to space it out over days, which for a number of reasons is important to any lawyer. They want to be able to, you know, leave, you know, certain testimony at the end of the day. They want to be able to time it and pace it and do things like that. And to have to shove it all into 12-hour blocks means that it's very difficult for people to sustain their attention. And that, of course, was McConnell's point. But I don't think he ever meant for that to be the case. I think he had set that up with Susan Collins in advance. as a way for her to come in and go, oh, no, no, you can't do that, Mitch. That's unfair. I really demand. So then he gave them 3 days to do it instead of just two, which is also completely inadequate. But it made it appear that he had conceded at this point. Probably more to the point, he also conceded on another point, which was allowing evidence in that had been introduced in the hearings, in the impeachment,
yeah,
in the House. Which he had said, no, we're not going to do that. Well, that, of course, was absurd. And there was no way he was, you know, even he didn't, I don't think, expected to do that. So my feeling is, and I could be wrong, maybe this was all just, you know, Susan stepping up and trying to be a good, so, you know, to be a nice moderate. But I really think that, you know, look, Mitch McConnell has one goal in all this. One goal only, and I think it supersedes his goal of protecting Donald Trump, and that is that he wants to maintain his majority in the Senate,
yep,
in 2020. So everything he does is an eye toward that, and part of that is giving some of these Republican senators some things that they can do to sort of pretend like they aren't just doctrinaire Trump, you know, Trump cultists, so that they can go to the voters, because they're going to be questioned about this. In fact, you know, you've got people like Bloomberg. They're going to pound these guys for these impeachment votes in their states, and I think they know that. So they need to have some, and that's what Mitch McConnell is doing. So having said that, you know, my impression of the trial, you know, from what we've seen, it's not over yet, is that, you know, you had two very, very different approaches to the trial. The House managers were extremely impressive, and I have to admit that I am surprised, because you rarely see the House of Representatives ever present themselves in a, you know, really
impressive way.
Right. You know, it's not their thing. They're kind of the populist, you know, people's representative, and they're always a little rowdy, and, you know, some more rowdy than others, but you just don't expect them to really be buttoned up and be able to present something like this in a way that you go, whoa. You know, any top lawyer in the country would look at the presentation they made on the first day and go, wow, these guys really have their case together. And even more than that, I think, was the fact that, look, when McConnell put out those rules and was signaling all along that he was not going to allow them to really be able to have time and breathing space to present their case the way they wanted, he wanted to get it over with as quickly as possible. I think that Schiff and his managers realized that they had to take every minute that they had before the public, and it's much more for the public than it is for the senators, whom I don't think they expect too much from on the Republican side, although, you know, hope springs eternal. But,
right,
you know, I think they know which way this is going. But so this is for public opinion, that they would use this amendment process, and they must have conferred with Schumer and worked this out, that Schumer would present these amendments, which fell under the rules of the Senate, giving them, I think it's 2 hours for each side, to present their arguments for an amendment, and that they would use those hours to actually sort of preview the case that was to come and preview the evidence, and even more than that, preview their professionalism and their seriousness by having this so well-produced kind of presentation, which is what they had. And mm-hmm. I don't think the president's team knew that. And they showed up, and they were like the kids who said, you know, their dog ate their homework. I mean, they just did not seem to be prepared. I think they thought it was going to be a political, you know, sort of argument between the two sides over these amendments, and were not expecting to have to rebut any kind of, you know, specifics. And so they looked, I think, quite foolish. They won, of course, because that's the, you know, the trial is fixed. But, you know, as I wrote in my Salon piece about this, you know, you only get one chance to make a good impression, a good first impression, and they didn't make it. And I think that that is going to affect them going forward. Not that it will change the outcome, but again, this is all about the election. It's about the senators.
Right.
It's about how the Democrats can parlay this into an argument against Donald Trump in November. So to that extent, in the early going, I think that the Democrats were really quite impressive and the Trump people were not.
I do think there was a missed opportunity along those lines, more by Schumer than the House managers. But let's take a break. We will talk more about that when we return. We also got to talk about the potential for witnesses to be called. A lot more to talk about in terms of this impeachment and, of course, how it may or may not implicate the Democratic primary. A lot of stuff going on. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Digby will rejoin me in just a moment. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Digby. So, Heather, in the last segment, you were making the point that you were impressed by the level of preparation that the House managers, the Democrats, showed up with into the Senate. You speculate that it surprised Trump's lawyers because they thought they were coming into basically a, I don't know, a cable news spot where they would argue to their peeps. But instead, they ran into sort of like well-designed. These are ostensibly attempts to convince the Senate for the need to subpoena documents and witnesses. And they were separate appeals per document, per trove of documents and per witnesses. I want to address that in a minute, but they came in and they, like you say, they used the opportunity of arguing as to why these things should be admitted, basically almost as a proxy to admit them in some way, right? Like, you know, it's impossible to know what John Bolton would say, but we do know everything that people around him said he said. It's impossible to know what Mick Mulvaney said, but we do know what Mick Mulvaney said in public. It's impossible to know what these documents said, but we do know that they exist because of FOIA requests and that they've been, you know, thoroughly redacted. And we have testimony as to what was happening in both sides of that email exchange. They did a good job presenting that. At one point, and we're still talking about day one here, Mitch McConnell wanted to sort of put them all into a tranche. All of the requests for subpoenaing documents, all of the requests to subpoena witnesses, and just have one omnibus vote so they didn't have to go so long. Chuck Schumer, to his credit, refused, said we're going to go ahead with the plan. But I also think this is a missed opportunity because you made the point in the last segment that this is really about, this is not about now. This is about in November. And this is not about the question as to whether Donald Trump is going to be removed from office. It's almost impossible to imagine that the Republicans at this point would ever remove him. I mean, I've been saying this since day one, unless they saw, you know, video of him running naked across the White House lawn chasing a young boy. But it is important for those races where you have vulnerable Republicans who want to distance themselves in some way, show some measure of independence from the president. You and I both can imagine what the ads are going to look like against Cory Gardner. There is going to be, you know, a series of little squares, and then there's going to be some writing next to it, and it's going to say voted with Trump, voted to protect Trump, you know, stopped witnesses. And, you know, the ad's going to go check mark, check mark, check mark. And Chuck Schumer was basically laying out a bunch of those check marks. And when McConnell said he wanted to put it all together so that his members only had to take one vote to reject all these things rather than 10 votes to reject them, Chuck Schumer should have really started to pound on this drum of you're hiding this from the American public. And the fact that you won't even discern between one witness or another as to whether we should call them is indicative of just how much you are Donald Trump's little puppet. You know, the idea that we could throw into this tranche of people who we want to subpoena some guy walking the street in Nebraska, in Omaha, Nebraska, some guy we pick up, and, you know, John Bolton, and you would just treat them the same is indicative of the fact that you're not looking to get to the truth. Now, you and I both know he's not looking to get to the truth, but this is a way that you create these theatrics and to sell this notion, because we are looking at a situation where 69% of the people in this country are in favor of calling witnesses. And if I was the Democrats, I wouldn't even call it subpoenaing documents. I would say, let's call a written witness. You know, like everything would be a vote on a witness with 69% of the population saying they want witnesses. But that's my, you know, in terms of the theater, everything else I thought was pretty good from the Democratic side. You know, to the extent that they have the ability to influence this. And I should remind people, if you live in, well, I don't care where you live, but if you live wherever you live, call your senator and tell them you want witnesses and whatnot. But, you know, if you live in Maine, if you live in Arizona, if you live in North Carolina or Colorado or Iowa or Alaska or Georgia or Tennessee, call your senators and tell them. Utah, call Mitt Romney and tell him you want witnesses, because there's polling out there to support that notion. And any type of anxiety that can be created amongst the Republicans in the Senate, I think, is going to be helpful by the time we get to November.
Absolutely. And I think you're right that, you know, I mean, the point of that whole opening salvo in this process, you know, was Schumer and of course the House managers working, you know, hand in glove, I think, to try and present this idea. I mean, it was to get that evidence in that they knew certain things, and all of it could be, I mean, theoretically, it could exonerate the president, right? I mean, you would think that somebody would assume that his followers would be saying, hey, you know, let's see the rest of these documents, because we know our dear leader is honest as the day is long, and we want to see it out there. But of course, you know, we know that isn't true. But that does explain why there are 70%, around 70% of the public that wants witnesses, because that includes a fair number of Republicans. That's not just Democrats and independents. That's also, you know, some conservatives who support Trump otherwise. And they obviously believe that, sure, bring on the witnesses. You know, that's only good for our guy. So that whole idea that, and I think what they're building up to, and I agree that they were slightly, you know, sort of inefficient at getting this across, at least on the Schumer side, is that this is a cover-up. It's a cover-up that they're hiding things, and that is what Cory Gardner and Martha McSally and Joni Ernst and the rest of these people who are in tough races, these Republican senators, are going to have to deal with, which is that because there are, you know, you and I have been talking about this for weeks, there is a lot of evidence that's still coming out. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know. Well, and every single time it happens, these people are going to have to answer, why did you help with the cover-up? Why wouldn't you have witnesses?
All right, we got to take a break. Digby, if you'll join me in the next hour, we got more to talk about in terms of impeachment. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back. Coming up, how Florida plans to keep ex-felons off the voting rolls. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey folks, Sam Seder here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick. And we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. In the November election of 2018, over 65% of Floridians voted to allow people convicted of a felony to have their voting rights reinstated. Here to discuss how the Republican state legislature is trying to prevent ex-felons from voting, Ari Berman from Mother Jones Magazine. So, Ari, we have a couple of things to talk about in terms of the vote, the right to people to vote in this country as it's being abridged in different places around the country. We may see hundreds of thousands of people kicked off the voter rolls in Wisconsin. We can talk about that. But let's start with, and you also have a massive piece in Mother Jones about Trump's stealth plan to preserve white electoral power. We will get to that in a moment. But let's start in Florida, where in 2018, the citizenry of Florida decided that people who have served their time in prison for felonies and have been released from prison deserve to have the right to vote restored to them. And we were talking about what I think it's 1.4 million people who were presumably eligible for a right to vote. And the Republicans in Florida apparently are very nervous about that prospect.
They are, Sam, and this has really been a remarkable story, remarkable in both a positive and a negative sense. It's remarkable because Florida had one of the worst records of any state, if not the worst record of any state, when it came to disenfranchising people with past felony convictions. Florida is one of the only states in the country that didn't allow you to vote even after you had served your time, that disenfranchised over 1.5 million people. In November 2018, the voters of Florida said they wanted to restore voting rights to people with past felony convictions after they had completed probation and parole. It seemed pretty simple. If you had a clean record, you would be able to vote unless you were convicted of certain crimes like murder or sexual crime. But that was pretty easily understood. Then, in the spring of last year, the Florida legislature got involved. Florida's Republican-controlled legislature got involved. And they significantly undermined this ballot initiative, and they significantly changed the meaning of the law. And they said that under this law, you didn't just have to serve your time, you had to pay off what they called all fines, fees, and restitution to be able to vote. Meaning that if you had a sentence and your sentence included a very large financial penalty, or even if your sentence included the fact that you were essentially paying off your incarceration, which is Florida's one of those states that does that, people owed tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, that the state of Florida knew they were never going to be able to pay back, but made them pay anyway. And now the state was saying, unless you pay off all of this money, you're not going to be able to vote. And that's where things stand right now.
So do we have a sense of how many of these sentencing documents? Because my understanding is the Supreme Court basically said, and this is a Florida Supreme Court, and we should add that the Florida Supreme Court is made up of a majority of people picked by the last Republican governor there. Is that right, Rick Scott?
Yes, and now also has people from the new Republican governor, Ron DeSantis. So it's a heavily, heavily Republican-dominated state Supreme Court.
And my understanding is the state Supreme Court said within the four corners, literally they said within the four corners of the sentencing document, do we know how many people who are sentenced and of this, you know, cohort of 1.4 million people who have been released from prison, how many of them had such fines or fees or the call for restitution within their like literal sentencing document?
Well, one of the big problems here is that Florida doesn't have a database of how much everybody owes. So that makes it very, very difficult to enforce the law that the Florida legislature passed because people don't know how much they owe. There has been research done into this. The best research I've seen is by Daniel Smith, who's a professor at the University of Florida. He testified as an expert on behalf of the ACLU, who's brought numerous lawsuits challenging this law by the Florida legislature. And he did a review of 48 of the 67 counties in Florida, and he found that 80% of people had some sort of fine or fee or restitution attached to their sentence, meaning that if 80% can't afford, if you assume that 80% of people have some sort of financial penalty attached to their sentence, and we don't know how many can afford it to pay it off, let's just say none of them can afford to pay it off, that would mean that of the 1.4 million people that were set to get their right to vote back, more than a million people would be disenfranchised, something like 1.1 or 1.2 million people, which would just be an absolutely staggering number of people to say you're going to get the right to vote back and then say, oh, by the way, you're not going to get the right to vote back unless you can afford to pay off all of your fines.
I have two questions that remain. One is practical and one is from a legal perspective. From a practical standpoint, does Florida now need to create a database of this? I mean, if I am I was formerly a convict, I go in to register. They say you were formerly a convict. Did you pay off your fees? I did. How would they go about, like, do I need to come back with a receipt? Is there a mechanics to this?
Florida claims they're going to create this database. The problem is some of these sentences are very old, like going back to the 70s and 80s, and it's going to be very difficult for them to get accurate information and also to know whether it's up to date, right? Because, like, you might have gotten some sort of financial penalty 20 years ago, but you're not necessarily going to get a receipt saying it's all been paid off 20
right.
years later. I mean, and so the whole thing is just a complete and total mess. And what's going to happen?
And that's by design.
Yeah,
that's by design. Right?
That's by design, exactly. This was a very simple thing, Sam. If you had completed probation and parole, which everyone can prove, and you weren't convicted of a certain really bad crime like murder or sexual offense, which anyone can prove, then you're eligible to vote. So it was actually very simple what the people were voting on. Now it's become incredibly complicated by design, as you say, so that one, people who are actually eligible to vote, who may not owe any money, they're going to be afraid to register for fear that they're going to make some sort of mistake that's going to land them potentially back in jail. We've seen very aggressive prosecutions already in other states like Texas for voter fraud, where a black woman in Texas, for example, who voted on supervised release when she didn't realize she was ineligible, got 5 years in prison. So, I mean, that's going to have a chilling effect. The second thing that's happened is tens of thousands of people, if not hundreds of thousands, if not a million people or more, are going to actually owe money, not be able to pay them off, and then not be able to vote. Now, the rub here is that a federal court also ruled in this case, and the federal court told the state of Florida, you need to create some mechanism so that people who can't afford to pay off their fines still can be able to vote, meaning you can't deny someone the ability to vote just because they're too poor to pay off their fine. So Florida has to create that system as well for people to show that they can't afford to pay, but they can still vote, and they haven't done that either. So there's just a ton of confusion for something that was actually very simple at the
right.
end of the day.
Well, like you say, that's probably by design. I have just one last question on that legal stuff, and then we got to take a break. Would the Supreme Court ever weigh in and say, hey, wait a second, this is a poll tax. That's illegal.
I don't think this Supreme Court's going to say that.
Right. Okay.
I haven't met a single voting restriction that John Roberts and the conservative justices on the Supreme Court haven't liked. So I'm very skeptical that the Supreme Court would give any sort of sweeping ruling here and would overturn what other Republican justices are saying. That said, they might not hear the court. The federal courts and the lower courts may say to the state of Florida, you need to do something. It may not be a perfect solution, but you need to do something. Then in the most extreme cases where people can't afford to pay off their fines, they're still able to vote. But again, the Florida legislature hasn't done that. So voting rights for, at this point, 1.4 million people are up in the air right now in Florida.
Well, he's just calling balls and strikes. So, all right, we got to take a break here. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the piece that you had in Mother Jones, Trump's stealth plan to preserve white electoral power. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. I'll be right back with Ari Berman.
I've always done the best I can.
Hey folks, Sam Seder here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking to voting rights expert Ari Berman about his piece in Mother Jones magazine, Trump's stealth plan to preserve white electoral power. So, Ari, in the last segment we were talking about, really, I mean, regardless of what the practical impacts are, in terms of the mechanics, the success of the Republicans in Florida to create enough confusion amongst the 1.4 million former convicts in Florida in terms of their status, in terms of their ability to vote, that could inhibit, you know, any type of like electoral power they might have. We will see what happens with that. In the meantime, you've written a blockbuster piece in Mother Jones about Trump's, what you call Trump's stealth plan to preserve white electoral power. Tell us about this plan.
So basically, you remember when the Trump administration proposed that there would be a citizenship question on the 2020 census. That was blocked by the Supreme Court in a very surprising decision by the conservative Supreme Court, which basically said the Trump administration lied about their reasons for adding this question. The Trump administration tried to put it on the form anyway, but eventually backed down. But at the same time that Trump announced that he wasn't going to push anymore for the citizenship question, he did another thing to try to influence the census in his favor and in the Republican Party's favor, which is he called for an executive order basically saying that every agency in the government had to provide citizenship information on people in the U.S. despite not having this question on the census. And then it would be used for redistricting purposes because currently districts are drawn in such a way that everyone is counted. They're based on total population. What Trump wants to do is he wants to exclude certain people from counting. He wants only voters to count in terms of total representation. He wants to exclude children and non-citizens. So those that are under 18 and not eligible to vote, or those that aren't citizens and are not eligible to vote, so that they don't count when districts are drawn. So why does this matter? Because if you don't count certain communities, particularly if you don't count children, if you don't count non-citizens when you're drawing a legislative districts, that means that that is going to take power away from younger, more diverse areas that are more likely to be represented by Democrats, and it's going to shift power to whiter, more conservative, and more Republican areas with fewer kids and fewer non-citizens, both legal and undocumented. So this is very much an under-the-radar thing that has gotten very little attention, but it has the power, after states redraw their districts in the next census, to really redefine political representation in America.
Is there any recourse? I just want to just remind people that as surprising as that Supreme Court ruling on the census was, it did come in the wake of a revelation of documents that showed that the Department of Justice was basically lying as to why it was requesting this question. It showed that the grandfather, the grandfather of gerrymandering, basically fed them this line as a way of justifying it. So, surprising, but not to their credit per se. But in this instance that you're talking about, in this attempt to change the one person, one vote, I guess is the way to express it. Is there a way to push back on this?
Yeah. So the way it works is that we do a census in 2020. After we do the census in 2020, states are going to begin redistricting both legislative and congressional districts based on the census data. And so what the Census Bureau is going to do is they're going to give the citizenship data to states, and then states can decide whether or not they are going to draw districts that exclude certain people from counting. Heretofore, no state has done this. And actually, there was an effort by conservative groups to try to force the state of Texas to draw districts in such a manner. They declined to do it in 2015, but there's going to be a renewed effort to try to get conservative states in particular to draw districts that exclude children and exclude non-citizens from counting. But the first thing that can happen is states can refuse to do this. And I imagine many states, if not most states, would refuse to do this, but I think there are still other states that are looking into it. The second thing is that if a Democrat is elected president in 2020, they can block the release of the citizenship data altogether. They can tell the Census Bureau, you're not giving this data to states. Now, that would, I think, provoke lawsuits, but nonetheless, the next president has that power. So all of this stuff is going to play out based on the results of the 2020 election, but I started writing about this now because it's something that I'm very, very concerned about, that I think if you changed how districts are drawn, it would be a massive shift in representation, and it would really change the whole meaning of one person, one vote, because one person, one vote, even though it's called one person, one vote, really has been interpreted as meaning everybody counts. Everyone is entitled to equal representation, no matter how old they are, no matter where they live, no matter what their status is. And what the Trump administration is saying is, no, we only want to count those people that are eligible to vote. And you're talking about excluding millions and millions and millions of people from political representation. And it would have a massive shift in a state like Texas, where so much of the demographic change is based on young people and based on people of color, in particular Latinos. It would essentially erase all of the demographic change in Texas and create a very, very white, heavily Republican state, as opposed to a state that is far more diverse and is changing rapidly and where Democrats are gaining power.
And this is also, I mean, this is about resources, right? I mean, this is ultimately the purpose of counting these people in the context of a district is to know what kind of resources you want, right? Because it's not just registered voters who drive on the highways. It's not just registered voters who drink the water, right? I mean, it's like, this is all about, the political power is supposedly divvied up in these districts as a way to make sure that the resources necessary for these districts are provided.
Exactly. And I mean, that's why it makes sense to count everyone, because everyone is a constituent. Everyone has needs. And I went down to Texas and I interviewed a Latina lawmaker by the name of Carol Alvarado, who represents a very diverse, a very young district in Houston. And I said, do you guys consider voters your constituents, or do you consider everyone your constituents? And she says, I consider everyone my constituents. I go to talk to kids at school and they're not voters, but I care what happens to their schools. And I deal with non-citizens all the time. And I care what happens to them. I care about a sane immigration policy and all of these other things. And so if you only start caring about the needs of voters, then you're ignoring a ton of people who are under the age of 18 and are not eligible to vote. They suddenly aren't counted. And you're also not including a whole lot of people that are non-citizens, some of whom are here legally and some of whom are here undocumented, but all of whom are working, paying taxes and contributing to their community. And what would happen as a result of this is that because districts have to be roughly equal in population, districts that have more kids and more non-citizens would have to massively increase their population to have enough voting age citizens that are equal to another district. So that would mean like a heavily Latino district in Texas might have to grow from 600,000 people to 1.2 million people, which would just put an insane amount of stress on the lawmakers representing these crazy inflated districts that suddenly have all these constituents that aren't being counted.
It would also mimic in some ways like the way that this distortion of democracy that we see in the Senate and that we see from things like the Electoral College. Ari Berman, thanks so much for your time today. We will link to that that piece in Mother Jones, Trump's stealth plan to preserve white electoral power. Great piece. Thanks again.
Thanks so much, Sam. Always great to talk to you.
Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones covering voting rights. He is the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Seder. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com. Support the show. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.